session number 1204 or 3.
Admiral McLean, Reel 3, which she shouldn't have done because every yard she made towards Brest was important to her. And we watched with interest what was happening. And she continued this turn and appeared to lose speed. And we waited for our aircraft to return to see whether anyone had scored a hit. And what had happened was that the last attack by the last torpedo bomber, and I think it's called Sub-Lieutenant Beale, failed to score a hit. So very gallantly, he went round again and had another go. I'm sorry, his first attack, he couldn't get into position to score a hit. So he very gallantly went round again, fired his torpedo, and hit her in the propellers.
Did you know him?
Oh, yes. But we didn't know about this till he landed on. Getting the aircraft back was preoccupying us more than almost anything, because it was dark by then and really rough. And he said he thought he scored a hit. And it all was true. And the Bismarck was then done, because she could not make enough ground to the eastward. The home fleet was by that time coming up from astern. And she was a sitting duck. We couldn't repair the damage. And she was eventually brought to action by the King George V and Rodney, I think, and whatever cruisers there were. And she blazed away. Her armament was in perfectly good condition. She was shadowed all night by the destroyers, the Cossack. The Afridi had been sunk by this time. Strangely enough, the Cossack appeared again with Admiral Vaughan, and they shadowed her all night. And she was capable of very accurate gunfire, as Captain Vaughan reported. So they had a hell of a time, and they kept... But they had no radar, you see. Had to be done visually. And they dodged in and out. And then up came the King George V with radar. And her, the rest of the home fleet. And attacked her. And, well, the story is well known. She wouldn't sink. And eventually the cruiser Dorsetshire had to be ordered to sink her with torpedoes, which was one up for the torpedo department of the Royal Navy. And the Dorsetshire, I think, I'm not certain about this, but I think she stopped to pick up survivors. And there was a report of a U-boat in the vicinity. And so she had to withdraw and leave them all to their fate.
You said earlier in the account that when you heard that about the Bismarck coming through the Denmark Straits, that you breathed a sigh of relief. Was the Bismarck a feared ship in the Royal Navy then?
No, I thought I'd have a nice sleep. I told you, whenever we went into Gibraltar, as soon as we got nicely snugged down, we were either called out to the Mediterranean, where we just left, or we were called out to the Atlantic to chase the Hipper. My reaction was entirely selfish.
Whilst the pursuit of the Bismarck was going on, were you and the rest of the officers on the Ark Royal kept informed as to what was happening?
By whom do you mean?
From the captain?
Oh, Lord, yes. Absolutely. It was a very well-run organisation. The organisation of an aircraft carrier then was that... The senior observer, I think he was called, was a commander, and he was in charge of briefing the air crews down below the bridge before they went off. And the captain was on the bridge and would or would not attend the briefing, but all the briefing for the attacks was done by the senior observer down below. And it was essential that everyone knew everything.
And you had the plot of the course of the Bismarck throughout the action?
Yeah. Yes. Well, I think we gave it up when she stopped. I mean, we certainly had this vital bit of this turn, which was the most elating thing. Couldn't believe it.
You thought that she was really going to escape to Brest?
Well, it looked like it. Mm. Everything was rather against us, what with the weather and this attacking the Sheffield and everything.
After the Bismarck, what do you remember about the service on the Arkryl after that?
Well, then we, I suppose it was after that, that we bombarded Genoa, which was, I suppose it was after that. I can't remember really whether it was before or after. But we set off from Gib and put a lot of shells from the Renown and again the Sheffield into the docks at Genoa, and the Ark Royal provided air cover hanging back well out of harm's way, except for the aircraft who came after us later, but they didn't do any damage, and that was a very successful operation. And then we had various convoys, of course, which were quite exciting. And by that time the Nelson had joined us. And I remember one convoy attacked by Italian torpedo bombers, I think. And one of them hit the Nelson in the on the port bow. And our aircraft were at that time returning from having done some sortie in the fighter patrols and everything. And they flew, I suppose, quite close to the Nelson. But anyway, we got a signal from Admiral Somerville saying words to the effect that your boys seem to take an unusual interest in Father's pence. I hope nothing is sticking out. The sort of signal he made. And then that was really all until we, when we went on doing these convoys. We went off on a Christmas day to attack the Hippo, as I keep on mentioning, which was suddenly appeared attacking a convoy out to the west of Portugal, and we didn't get her, but we got a couple of merchant ships. And that was our routine until the sad day when we came back from one of these trips, and at about 5 o'clock in the evening on a lovely November evening within 18 miles of Gibraltar a U-boat got us.
Can you describe what you remember of that?
Yes, very well. I was having a cup of tea on the bridge with the signal officer, and we'd already given notice of what time we were going to get into harbour. We were undoubtedly relaxed, and the first thing I remember was a bang and a lot of smoke coming up one of the aircraft lifts on the flight deck, which was abreast the bridge. Captain was in his cabin having a cup of tea, and immediately all the communications within the ship failed, which was one of the difficulties, and she began taking a list, and it wasn't long before we discovered there'd been a hit underneath us with one of these magnetic warheads, I suppose, and the boiler rooms were flooding, and we lost all electric power. And because the furnaces went out, and I wouldn't wish to go into details about all that because it's all been recorded so carefully, but she went on listing, and we had no real order which to give the ship's company about a situation like this, I mean, about abandoning ship. And we had, of course, an enormous number of aircraft people on board who weren't wanted. They were in the way when the ship was there. We wanted to save them and get them out of the ship. And so we ordered everybody to muster on the flight deck. And owing to the lack of communications on the ship, this had to be passed by what are called call boys, which were boys who went round to the bosun's call, saying, "Do you hear there?" And like a game of rumours, you know, you pass messages from mouth to mouth, and it ends up absolutely different to when it started. And the rumour got round that they were ordered to abandon ship. And this was discovered and immediately cancelled, but too late to stop the engineers from, as far as I can recollect, from again dousing the boilers, which they'd managed to get going, because the abandoned ship required that they should put them out. And this was awful, because if we'd kept those boilers alight, we would have had electric power and we could have probably got the ship into jib. And there was very little. We could not get the boilers going again, because by that time the ship had got a strong list and the boiler room ventilation was underwater. And so the destroyers came alongside and took off as many as were deemed not necessary for the ship to get her into jib. We still thought we could. We got a tug from jib and started being towed. The list was getting quite severe, but we were so close that I understand even Lord Gort, who was the governor of Gibraltar, went up to the southern end of Europa Point to have a look at us through his field glasses. They could see the whole thing going on. And we didn't make much headway with this tug. And the night wore on, a beautiful calm night, and the list got more and more severe, and eventually it was perfectly obvious she was not going to get in, and so the captain ordered us to abandon the ship, and we were taken off by an MTB, I think, and destroyer Lafori came alongside. We had made some efforts before that from the Lafori to put electric leads on board and try and get some power to our own pumps. But this simply didn't work out. We couldn't get enough power from the destroyer. And that had to be abandoned. And so she just gradually got more and more of a list. And shortly after we left, she heeled over and sank. Which is very sad, because errors were undoubtedly made. We might have got her in. But I did say much earlier on that she was in a very bad state, like a worn-out motor car. She'd never had a refit. And no doubt a lot of the technical difficulties which she experienced down below wouldn't have happened if we'd had our machinery in better order.
What happened to you personally after the loss of the Ark Royal?
I and the rest of us spent our time trying to get the Admiralty to give us new uniforms. It's strange that when your ship sinks, you are absolutely left with nothing. And
so you didn't get them as a matter of course?
Well, from jib and all that. There was a Gives there, but no, they came in the end. But I mean, I remember going home dressed in a soldier's uniform. And my children didn't know me. They said I thought I was a sailor or a soldier. We all got back. Some of us went back in the Nelson, who was due to go home. Some of us went back very sadly in a light fleet carrier called, I can't remember the name, which was torpedoed. so that they were drowned. We otherwise, we only lost one man in the Ark Royal. He'd been asleep in the lower steering position, just under where the torpedo hit, and he was overwhelmed before he could wake up.
But you went back on the Nelson.
I know, I went back in the Manxman. There was, again, one of these awful courts of inquiry. And I think Lord Cork came out again to investigate whether there should be a court-martial of the captain. Hearsay was that Winston Churchill has said, I want a culprit for this. And I had to stay with some others to give evidence at this court of inquiry, which indeed led to a court-martial.
What job did you take up in the Navy after this?
And then I went to a battleship called the Anson, which I enjoyed very much, but it wasn't quite the same thing. We spent our time escorting convoys to Russia. And we saw no particular action. And yep. I'd left the ship. I got promoted to commander, and I left the ship just before the Scharnhorst was sunk.
This was the Battle of North Cape.
Yeah.
Christmas 1943.
That's right.
Was it then that you got the Admiralty job in London?
Then I went to the Admiralty in London, yes.
You were telling me earlier, on a different occasion, that you were in London during the V-weapons raids.
Yes.
Do you remember them starting?
Yes.
What do you remember about the start of them?
Well, I remember that my wife came to London from Northumberland, where she was living, just to have a few days with me on the night of the first V1. We'd never heard of the damn things before.
What was people's initial reaction to them?
You know, everything went on just the same. I don't remember any initial reaction. I remember during it, on a Sunday, we worked most of the week I was in a room on the south side of the Admiralty on a Sunday morning. There was a hell of a bang, and this was the guards' chapel being blown up. We didn't know that at the time, but it's just interesting. I mean, we heard the bang. Great thing about the V2s was that if they didn't stop their engines, you were okay. If they shut off, you knew they were about to dip.
These were the V1s, were they?
V1s, yes. If they went on, you knew they were going past you and some other chap was going to get them. But if they switched their engine off, it was they were starting to dive.
Did Londoners really take it in their stride, or was morale affected?
I find that awfully difficult to answer. I think after the bombing of London before, they took it in their stride. They'd about learnt to live with these things. Well, not these things, but learnt to live with dangers from the air. But I think that's very difficult for me to answer, because my life was spent between my lodging and the Admiralty, and I don't really know.
Where were your lodgings?
In Kensington.
Do you remember any other specific V1s or V2 hits on particular streets or buildings that came near you?
Yes, John Barker's was hit in Kensington High Street. But that was the middle of the day, I wasn't there.
Was that a shop?
Was that what?
A shop?
A shop, yes. A very big, very big shop. I don't think there was an awful lot of casualties. But I'm not at all clear about the other casualties for the V1s. As I say, I think people got used to these things.
So
I do remember walking home one night, one summer's night in St. James's Park, and one of these things came over, and to our shame, I suppose, everyone around in the park, people walking home, that we all flung ourselves on the grass. The thing didn't switch off, so we got up again.
So you didn't feel that this was a weapon which Hitler could win the war with at the last minute.
No, I didn't. Then I was young and inexperienced. We'd already, you see, got into the invasion had taken place and everything. I mean, we couldn't believe these things could go on for very long.
Because of the sites being overrun?
Yes.
Did you hear of people evacuating from London because of the Reds?
No.
Did you feel that some parts of London were getting hit worse than others?
I suppose South London was. Kent and South London, where they came from. And, strangely enough, the Regent's Park area, I think, got it a lot.
What do you remember about VE Day? Were you in London then?
Yes, I was still at the Admiralty. I think I was.
Do you remember celebrations taking place?
No. My mind is quite blank on VE Day. I'm not certain I haven't left the... No, I can't remember. I can't answer you very helpfully over that.
Did it take much time to readjust to peacetime life after the war? For people like yourself who had been in it?
Not at all, no. Beginning with, there was this interlude in the Pacific, you see. The Japanese war wasn't over. And as far as I was concerned, my ship stayed out in the Pacific for several months after VJ Day. And there was a good deal of celebration in Australia and New Zealand and places. And business of returning Allied... rescuing Allied prisoners of war from various Far Eastern countries, and it sort of worked down very slowly, and then we came back in the aircraft carrier, which took a month or something, and the time we got home, I remember thinking how all the people who came to meet us seemed to be dressed in brown, whereas all the people who'd waved goodbye to us in Australia were dressed in bright colours.
What ship did you serve in the Far East?
I was in the aircraft carrier Indefatigable, and then in the can't remember the name of the other one. Indefatigable, not Indomitable. Can't remember. Indefatigable eventually became home in. And that was that.
Where did you operate against the Japanese?
Never. I never did. Because by the time I was sent out to the Pacific, the actual day before I left for England, the bomb on Nagasaki was dropped. Or Hiroshima, whichever one it was. And by the time I was airborne almost, the Japanese had given in. So all I arrived for was the celebrations.